The Irish Times Business Podcast in association with Irish Life.
We can help your company and your employees look forward to tomorrow. We know Irish Life. We are Irish Life.
Hello and welcome to Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock, a podcast from the Irish Times. You can subscribe to this podcast for free on iTunes, and it's also available on our website, irishtimes.com/podcasts. Later in the show, we'll hear about the challenges facing the Irish timber industry by Brexit. But we'll begin, as always, with a roundup of the main business stories of the week. And I'm joined in studio by Eoin Burke Kennedy of the Irish Times. Eoin, you're very welcome.
Hi, Ciarán.
Now, we're going to begin with the Eighth Amendment referendum. It's coming up later this month. And this week, very significant moves by Facebook and by Google. Different moves, but they've decided to ban foreign ads and indeed all ads in the case of Google. And that might in any way influence this referendum.
Yeah, Google's actually gone a step further than Facebook by announcing a complete ban on all advertising to do with the referendum, unlike Facebook, which just announced a ban on foreign bought ads. So they've gone a kind of step further. And a decision applies to all Google's advertising platforms, including AdWords and YouTube, and will come into effect on Thursday this week. So
what's behind this, Eoin?
Well, you can't help but linking it back originally to the allegations of Russian interference in the US election, and more recently the Cambridge Analytica scandal, has finally prompted these big tech firms to take action. A lot of critics might say it's very late in the day to be announcing this. The referendum's kind of campaign's all but done. We're 2 weeks away from the vote, and that was the same accusation that was leveled at these firms in the US, that they didn't really move when there was lots of signs of...
Do we have any sense of what influence, let's say, or how many ads have already been posted on Facebook or Google relating to the 8th? Or do we have any sense of how much money has been spent, particularly from abroad, or what influence any of this might have had today? Is there any analysis of that?
Well, simply put, we don't. And that's the whole point. There's a group called the Transparent Referendum Initiative, and that tracks online advertising around the vote. And 2 weeks ago, Liz Carlin, its founder, said her group had picked up 144 different pages, this is on Facebook, paying for ads at one point in time over the last few months. Now, we don't know who's paying for these ads. We don't know what groups are behind them. And that's the whole point. There's a complete kind of opaqueness around this. And that seems to have prompted the action. Twitter seems to be kind of first off the mark. They have a more long-standing advertising restrictions around various health issues, including abortion. But they've banned all advertising on the Irish referendum from the outset. So it seems like Facebook and Google are now only coming into the fray. The interesting thing is that, you know, the Irish abortion referendum looks like it's going to be a test for a lot of these controls that are going to come in and probably be in play for the next US general election.
Okay, so and do we know, for example, if let's say there's an Irish general election, at some point in the next 12 months, whether there's going to be a similar ban on ads?
Well, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, Facebook is only banning foreign paid ads. And obviously these firms are exploiting a kind of loophole in the Irish law. We know there's restrictions around political parties and political campaigns, but there's obviously no restrictions around advertising in the social media space. So I think a lot of these firms are kind of trial testing a few of their kind of... new rules, new restrictions and new apps during the Irish election to see how they're going to work.
All right, let's take a look at property prices now. Some new data from the CSO showing that property prices in Ireland continue to soar.
Yeah, actually we even use the headline rate of inflation moderated to 12.7%, which will...
Well, that's not going to gladden the heart of anyone. An annual rate of inflation of 12% in property, I mean,
come on. It's a testament to the heat in the market that we would even talk about prices moderating and still being rising by 12.7%. But, it's pretty torturous for people who are off the property ladder to be looking at these figures tumbling down. To put this in real money terms, a house or an apartment that cost, say, $300,000 last March 2017, could now be $338,000. So by sitting out... it's 38,000 dirr, which is a hefty sum of money.
And for first-time buyers, they would need 10% of 38 as for a deposit. So that's another 3,800 euro they would have to save. Not easy to do.
No, not at all.
Especially when they're paying soaring rents as well.
Exactly. And wages aren't matching wage rises, even though they are moving forward, aren't matching anything like this. So it into the figures, you know, the highest price growth in the capital, price rises in Dublin were put at 12.1% in the 12 months to March, which is slightly cooler than the rest of the country, but Dublin seems to be always a little bit ahead. And then the highest price growth in the capital was Dublin City, where prices were rising at 14%, and the lowest was in South Dublin, where prices are rising at just under 10%. So even in the places in Dublin that are rising the least, the inflation rate is still fairly high.
Do you have any sense of the continued impact of cash buyers on the market?
Well, they've typically been taught to account for around 50% of purchases. Mm. And that's probably the main reason why the central bank's mortgage lending restrictions haven't dampened headline inflation. They have certainly, stopped people borrowing too much, but they haven't dampened the runaway inflation that we're seeing because cash buyers obviously aren't, stopped or restricted from borrowing.
Right. Now, we know prices in Dublin are pretty saucy. What about the rest of the country? Where are the most expensive places outside Dublin?
Yeah, the most expensive air code, according to the latest figures, outside Dublin, and many people will wonder is how far outside Dublin is Greystones in County Wicklow, which is probably on commuting distance. And the average or mean price in the last 12 months there was 424,000. And then the least expensive place in the country by air code was Ballyhonus in County Mayo, where the mean price was 75,000. So massive regional spread there in prices.
All right. Well, I think the message for people is head to Mayo. Okay, so we're going to move to the ESRI now, and suggesting a report from the ESRI suggesting that raising excise duty on diesel would reduce pollution and raise €500 million for the Exchequer. The Budget Oversight Committee was considering this at a meeting earlier this week.
Yeah. Professor Edgar Morgenroth of Dublin City University's Business School was at the Oireachtas Committee yesterday.
He's formerly of the ESRI, isn't he?
He is, yeah. And he penned a report with the ESRI a few months ago, which assessed basically the impact of various tax measures on the environment here.
We should say, I suppose, just to remind people that if you're a diesel driver, you'll notice as fact that diesel prices per litre are generally, 8-10 cents cheaper per litre than petrol.
Yeah. So Ireland currently adds 48 cents of excise duty to each litre of diesel purchased compared to 59 cents for petrol. So the context of all this, Kieran, is that in 2008, when the Greens were in power and global concern about rising CO2 was at its height, the government began, like other governments in Europe, to incentivize diesel use over petrol. And so, 10 years on, we have now a much greater use of diesel vehicles. So the problem was that at the time, we didn't really consider the health implications and the pollution implications of diesel. And so while they're lower on CO2 emissions than petrol cars, they're higher on things like nitrous oxide and particulates.
And I think other countries are beginning the move to equalisation, aren't they? I think in the UK, for example, they've already started down that road. But in Ireland, perhaps a little bit different in that our truck industry, our haulage industry, which is quite important to the economy, largely, if not exclusively, based on diesel. A lot of the buses traversing our roads are based on diesel. And people in rural areas would argue that they need diesel to get around because it's much more economical. They're travelling longer distances and so forth.
Yeah. And I suppose Professor Morgenroth was asked actually by Fianna Fáil's John Lahart yesterday, what did he appreciate that those who bought cars in 2008 in good faith that they were kind of cleaner vehicles are now finding themselves on the wrong side of the pollution equation and perhaps facing higher taxes
and lower values in terms of trade-in and so forth.
Indeed. And he said he appreciated that, and obviously, his study was there to show that if the government went in one sweep to equalise, this is what the Exchequer would get, 500 million. But he was sort of hinting that the government may need to take a more phased approach.
Now, there was an expectation in the last budget that the government might make a move. They didn't. Any sense it's going to happen this year?
Yeah, I thought actually there was going to be a move in the last budget, but it seems that there was a bit of lobbying on the part of the hauliers that may have cancelled that out. And obviously, the fact that the infrastructure for electrical vehicles or cleaner vehicles isn't actually there, and a lot of people in Ireland are facing more regional commutes, makes diesel cars more economical. So that would be a factor. So it seems maybe unfair to penalise them at this stage.
Okay, and finally, I should ask you, Owen, are you a diesel or a petrol owner yourself?
I'm a diesel, I'm afraid. afraid.
Right, okay. Important to declare that. I think I am too. All right. We'll leave it there. Owen Burke Kennedy, thank you for joining us. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll hear about the challenges faced by the Irish timber industry caused by Brexit. Back in a few moments.
At Irish Life, we can tell you that 49% of employees in Ireland don't think about tomorrow. They don't have a pension plan. We can help you help them. Because if you're involved in running your company's pension plan, we can administer it for you. With our member-specific investment solutions, online access for employers, trustees and members, and always-on smartphone apps. Just call one of our corporate team on 01704 1845. Visit irishlifecorporatebusiness.ie or contact your pension consultant to find out how we can help your company think of tomorrow. We know Irish Life. We are Irish Life. Irish Life Assurance PLC is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. All information sourced for Irish Life September 2014.
Now, welcome back to Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock. In this part of the show, we're going to be considering the impact of Brexit on the Irish timber industry. The sector contributes about €2.3 billion to the Irish economy each year and supports 12,000 jobs in rural Ireland. But with some 78% of the output exported overseas, the implications of Brexit are obvious. Here to tease them out with me are Cuilce CEO Fergal Leamy, John Murray, the owner of family-owned Murray Timber in Galway, and Lucinda Creighton, the chief executive of Vulcan Consulting, who's doing some advising in this whole area. Lucinda, maybe you could just sort of give us the backdrop to all of this. Just explain to people, they probably don't realise the size and scale of the timber industry in Ireland and the fact that we do export so much of our product.
Yeah, sure. So I think it's fair to say that people have been very familiar and there's been a lot of focus on the implications of Brexit, potential implications of Brexit, depending on the nature of Brexit, for the agri-food sector in particular. So there's been a real focus on that. And people are probably not so aware, because it's quite dispersed across the country, of the implications for the timber industry. But it's very big, and you'll hear from Fergal and John in terms of the implications, the scale of the business. So there are about 12,000 rural jobs supported by the timber industry, working across forestry and sawmills and so on. And it is a sector that is hugely dependent on the UK market. It's a very specific product, obviously, very sensitive to climate, and obviously we benefit from proximity to the UK. So it's been pretty seamless up to now, and depending on how the negotiations unfold over the next couple of months, whether the UK leaves the customs union, whether there can be some agreement around the customs union, or whether we face, which is looking certainly increasingly to be a very significant risk, that we end up, you know, with this sort of cliff edge scenario without any solution to the customs and border issue. You know, there is a very significant risk then for lots of sectors in the Irish economy, including timber.
Yeah, you're a former politician, obviously, and you were a minister with a European portfolio in the past Fine Gael Labour coalition government from 2011 onwards. What's your read of the Brexit negotiations and how it's going at the minute?
Well, it's certainly high wire stuff. There's a problem, because normally in a negotiation you have two sides that are fairly coherent in what they want to get out of it. We have an EU side which is monstrous in terms of its scale compared to the UK, so much bigger.
27 member states.
27 countries. And very, very coherent and cohesive, which was not anticipated. I think it's fair to say that the UK certainly believed, and I think a lot within the EU believed, that there would be a lot of fragmentation amongst the member states in the negotiation. But actually, it has transpired that it is very coherent. And on the other side, you have huge disarray in British politics. You have a Conservative-led government, now a minority government relying on the DUP, which is, you know, where there is open warfare at cabinet meetings, where there is no agreed position on how they should leave the EU. And then even in the opposition benches, you have, a lack of clarity from the main opposition party, the Labour Party, with Jeremy Corbyn, who is an innate Eurosceptic, being sort of outflanked by much more pro-European members of his own parliamentary party who want a softer Brexit. So it really is a game of roulette at the moment, I think.
But is this not just sort of part of the normal cut and thrust of these kind of negotiations? And I watched the This Week program on BBC most weeks, and Michael Portillo always makes the point, and he's obviously a Brexiteer, but he always makes the point that at the 11th hour, the 11th day and so forth, there will be a deal done.
Well, I certainly hope so. I don't think it's the norm in terms of political negotiation. It's not normal to have a cabinet that can't make up its mind in terms of what actually wants. That is quite unusual. And even the lopsided nature in terms of size of the negotiating partners is unusual. So it's not sort of political business as normal. We'll definitely see a big clash, I think, at the June European Council, the summit of the heads of state and government. That is the deadline that has been set by the Irish government for a resolution to the Irish border question, which has much broader implications, as we have seen now, on the whole question of the customs union. There is, I think, a very big possibility that there could be a breakdown in the negotiations at that point. I think it's highly unlikely that there will be any resolution to these issues in June. It certainly will go to the wire in terms of the European Council in October, but that really is the very final point where there can be agreement, because at that stage you have to go to the ratification process, you have to have a vote in the House of Commons, you have to have a vote in the European Parliament. And there is a very strong risk in the midst of all of this that Theresa May loses a vote in the House of Commons next month. There are two really important bills coming into the House of Commons. She lost a non-binding vote last week where her own party, members of her own party, revolted. It was non-binding, but it was indicative. She could lose if they cross the aisle again. She could lose votes on the customs union actual binding legislative votes later this month. And there's also, I think, an interesting dynamic to all of this, which is the role of Sinn Féin, because her margin now is so tiny and minuscule in Parliament. If Sinn Féin decide to sort of, you know, enter stage left and cast their votes
In Westminster.
Well,
that's highly unlikely, isn't it?
I'm not so sure. I think that if it comes down to it and there's a really tight margin, there is a real possibility that Sinn Féin will see a big opportunity for themselves to be the kingmakers and to actually defeat the British government.
Well,
their
newest member of Westminster, who won the by-election recently in the North, made it very clear during the week that she's no intention of taking up her seat. And that was the mandate the party has. Mm-hmm. It was put to the people, put to the electorate, and they accepted that.
Sure. And, you know, I've been around politics long enough to know that, you know, politicians get mandates, but mandates can be interpreted in different ways. There's a very clear mandate also, which could be argued, from the nationalist and republican community in Northern Ireland, and indeed broadly in elements of the unionist community in Northern Ireland, to stay in the EU, certainly to stay in the customs union and single market. And that could very well impact on decision making within that party in due course. Anyway, that's going a little bit off topic, but it is very interesting, and it could be a very, very important turning point at some point, either later this month or in October, or indeed when it comes to ratification of the exit bill when it goes before the House of Commons later this year. So very interesting political times ahead, I would say.
John Murray, yours is a family-owned company based in Galway. Tell us what Brexit might mean for your company.
Brexit is creating a lot of uncertainty for our company. 60% of our exports go to the UK. This would lend itself back to the time when we had the bust, when we had market failure within our industry, and the industry was on a 3-day week, week on, week off. You know, that is the scenario we are facing as an industry.
Just give us a sense for the sort of size and scale of your business. How many truck movements, for example, do you have in and out of Britain each week, or maybe north south?
Well, as a company, we've 130 truck movements per day.
Per day?
Per day.
Right.
No, not all of those are north-south or east-west, but, you know, internal.
Pretty seamless at the minute, as given that Ireland and the UK are both members of the European Union. If Britain opts out of the customs union, what does that mean? Or what's your fear about what it might mean?
Well, there's a number of fears. Delays be a big fear. Bureaucracy be a big fear. And one of major concerns is the lack of backloads from the UK. We export based on backloads, which is generally...
What's a backload now?
A backload is... So you have your primary load, which is coming from the UK to Ireland. They're always looking to fill that trailer on the way back. Mm. And that's a backload. The circular route has to create revenue to cover the cost of that route. Generally, the backload is cheaper than the primary load. If it becomes a situation, and we're seeing it with all these the Brexit buster of the boat that has gone out to Zeebrugge from Dublin, was the one to Santander. All of a sudden, the land bridge, the UK land bridge, will be minimised.
These are ferries that are essentially bypassing the UK to continental Europe.
And if that's the case, then these backloads will no longer be backloads. They'll be primary loads. And it'll be tantamount to a hidden tariff. Transport is a big cost for us. We're a bulky good. And it's potentially a 10% tariff if we end up with backloads.
So you'd end up paying an extra 10% on what you're already paying. What's your...
No, we don't. We'll end up paying twice as much as what we pay at the moment. And that, at the moment, equates to about 10%
of tariff. Okay. How many jobs are at stake at your business?
There's 160 jobs full-time, and we've another similar figure indirectly to work for us on a continuous basis.
Okay. Now, Brexit obviously has been in the ether for the past couple of years, but we're only hearing from the timber industry now. Why is that? Why is it taking so long to get your case, to make your case on the public stage?
I suppose lack of organisation. The industry can be a bit fragmented. It's very hard to be organised with your greatest competitors. And that is what we are. The Timber Industry Brexit Forum, which was set up in conjunction with Quilcha, was a good forum to allow the industry to gather and put a case together for our concerns as to what Brexit is bringing and possible solutions.
Yeah. Fergal, let's talk about Quilcha. It's a state agency. Obviously, a lot of people know or think they know about Quilcha and what exactly you do. But just fill us in, first of all, on the sort of size and scale of your operations.
Yeah, so Quilcha today, we own and operate 7% of the country's land, and we run three businesses off it. We have our core forestry business, which supplies logs to people like John, who then process that into timber into the UK. We then have a renewable energy business, which we're now one of the largest providers of renewable energy in the form of wind farms in this country. And we have Medite SmartPly, which manufactures MDF and OSB, which largely goes to the UK and to about 32 countries around the world. And in total, we have about 1,000 people directly employed, and we have another 2,500 contractors across the country.
Just in terms of Brexit, what will it mean for Quilcha?
So I think overall for Quilcha, given that we have our core business is forestry and a core business supplies the timber to the UK, in essence, what we're trying to do here is grow the overall sector. The industry as a whole is a growth story. It's got an opportunity to double in size over the next 10 years. And there's very few industries in Ireland can claim that. And so this story is as much about trying to protect that growth as it is about protecting the existing jobs. And if you look at the entire industry, there are 12,000 people who are employed in the industry today.
In rural Ireland as well.
In rural Ireland. And for perspective, I mean, people talk about the tech industry, but that's more than Google, PayPal, Airbnb and LinkedIn combined employ in this country. And if you think about the impact it has on every rural economy across the country, it's significant. Not only that, the growth potential over the next 5 or 10 years is significant. And that's not just us trying to talk up the industry. The trees are actually in the ground. They've been planted over the last 20 years. And when they're harvested, you're going to see a doubling of the timber supplied on this island over the next 10 years. And a lot of that timber needs to find a home. Today, 70% of that goes to the UK. And we would imagine that majority of that growth will also go to the UK in future years, which is why, with the impact of Brexit, we're certainly in trying to ensure that we manage our businesses in a way that protects us and protects that growth in the future.
So what contingency planning has Quilcha been doing since the Brexit vote?
So in the first thing we've done is we've brought the industry together to try and understand what the implications are for our own industry and trying to understand how can we navigate potential things like border crossings that might occur in the future, minimise the impact that they will have. In our Medite SmartPly business, we've been looking at potentially developing warehouses in the UK. We've reconfigured our UK business, which is based in Dartford in the UK. And we've brought, probably counterintuitively, some of our offices in from Holland and Germany into the UK. The big challenge for us is to be seen increasingly as a UK-based business in our Medite SmartPly business. And the reason for it is that today, our customers, such as the large distributors like Travis Perkins, B&Q in the UK, they see us akin to a homegrown player. And we can deliver timber to them within 24 hours. If in the new future that becomes more difficult, they might pause before they will contract with us or buy from us. And so we need to be seen as much as possible as a UK-based business.
So what about developing new markets, moving away from the UK and looking elsewhere?
So we are certainly in Medite SmartPly, we currently deliver to 32 countries. We are increasing the amount that we can deliver to other countries. But there are two things in a broader business that will hold us back. firstly, the sheer weight of the product. We're delivering very heavy product, and the transport costs and the logistics, you know, don't make that as attractive as people sourcing those products closer to their home markets. The second piece is that in the timber industry and the timber that we provide into the UK, it's suitable for the UK market in the standard. So it goes into roofing, it goes into flooring of a specification that is not adapted in other European countries. So there are some barriers there to us naturally going to those other markets. And I suppose the other overall piece is the UK is the second largest importer of timber in the world and happens to be on our doorstep. And regardless of what happens with Brexit, we still see the UK market as being hugely important in the future. It's just trying to understand how do we navigate that, which is the work of the Brexit Forum.
John, there already has been a financial impact, hasn't there, from Brexit? I mean, the currency translation, sterling has weakened against the euro, I think, what, 15, 16%? So is that already biting you?
It's 27%.
27%, right.
Because Brexit started impacting a year before the vote. We've seen the, you know, sterling was down at 70p. It climbed 10% prior to the vote. It climbed 10% that day and another 7% since. So, yes, it has impacted us greatly. But the thing about it is the market has accepted that it has to source the material. And if that's the case, you know, they're going to have to pay for it. The absolute values over in the UK have covered that 27%.
Right. What kind of margins are you operating off?
It'd be very tight margins.
Do you want to give us a sense of it?
Typically, the sector would be somewhere in the region of 5%.
Okay, so thin margins. Fergus, so you've come together as an industry now, perhaps haven't been as cohesive in the past.
Right.
And you're now focused on this Brexit issue. And, you know, where do you go from here? Or what do you do from here? Are you lobbying the government? I mean, what's the purpose of this? What are you hoping to achieve?
As an industry, and I think actually reading Cliff Taylor's piece in the Times this morning was interesting. And he describes Brexit as the Russian doll and the layers of complexity that are there is absolutely right. And for us as an industry, what we wanted to do was put forward in simple language, what are some of the potential impacts and what are some of the potential solutions that would help our industry? Now, you could be writing a lot of this for several different industries. We happen to be honing in on the timber industry because of...
Well, let's focus on timber then. So what are the solutions?
So when we've looked at the different crossings, the different arrangements in different countries, things like just practical interchangeability of customs officials on the customs border, should there be one. Automatic number plate recognition. Simple, practical pieces that allow us to, over the next year to get ready for what may inevitably be some checks on the borders. One of the important things here, Kieran, is that we don't have the luxury of waiting till March 1st next year. We have to be getting ready now because any changes we make to our systems will take at least 12 months to implement, if not longer. And so the more work we can do now, the better. You ask the question, what are we going to do with this? Well, we're already talking to our own government. We're in Brussels next month, informing them about what our ideas are, and in the UK. And really what we're trying to do here is that we're not the most attractive industry in the world. And therefore, when it comes to the long list of industries that people will be writing protocols for, we're probably bottom of the pile. So our idea is, well, let's put forward something that people can actually take that is reasonable. And hopefully that'll become the blueprint for what they implement for our industry.
Solid, not sexy, perhaps, is the way to describe the timber
industry.
Probably,
right, okay. Accurate.
Now, lessons to be learned, perhaps, from the Norway-Swedish border. Sweden, obviously, inside the EU, Norway outside.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of lessons on the use of technology, the automatic number plate recognition that you see there, and the preferred trader status that you actually have between those countries. They've been doing this for years. And what we need to start doing is begin to think about those practical solutions, putting the technology in place. If you look at the border between those two countries, there's an awful lot of rural outposts that have technology now to be able to recognize number plates. And if they're on the trusted trader system, there are no issues. If they're not, then there will be checks. They're the practical pieces that we need to begin to think about. And I know there's a lot of political engagement and debate going on at the moment, but as an industry, we can't wait for that. And we do need to start thinking about those in the event that there are going to be border checks in the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I suppose all the timber has to be transported by ferry, of course. So you have to go into a ferry port, presumably in the UK,
well,
with your product.
40,000 of our movements are east-west, but there's another 40,000 that are north-south. So we would actually be as concerned about the north-south implications as we would the east-west. And for us, you know, if you think about there being 100,000 movements outside this country every year, that's a significant piece that we need to make sure we get right on the border of Ireland, but also on the ports that we have into the UK.
Yeah, Lucinda, the British side seems to be suggesting that technology can solve all of this, certainly on the north-south element. I mean, I keep hearing Jacob Rees-Mogg, for example, talking about how technology can deal with all of this. What do you think?
Well, Jacob Rees-Mogg is a font of all wisdom on customs unions and the future of our relationship. No, I think I suppose what the timber industry has done is focus very much on the practical solutions in the case of I suppose the eventuality that none of us want to see. So nobody wants the UK to leave the customs union. And you know, the smart solutions that that we have looked at in the Norway-Sweden border, also the US-Canadian border, which obviously is entirely different. Neither country is a member of the EU, but they have very interesting advances in technology which they're using, which allows for a fairly seamless
A free trade agreement, NAFTA.
They have NAFTA, but they also have, you know, a lot of developments, particularly in the last 5 years, which have allowed for much smoother logistical arrangements between the two countries. So there's a lot of really useful stuff there. But I guess placing it in the context of the political conundrum around the Good Friday Agreement and so on, you know, those solutions, you know, don't solve those problems. They're different problems for a different day, and they're obviously very much at the core of the EU's negotiating approach and agenda right now. You know, so they're sort of separate issues, if you like. I mean, these are the practical solutions to how you would manage the trade between Irish ports and UK ports, or just, you know, truck movements north south of the border. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, the timber industry can't solve the challenges around the political challenges around the Good Friday Agreement and that bigger picture piece. But what they can do is look at solutions to the practicalities. If it is the case that that,
and I presume you've been bending the ear of the Irish government and indeed EU officials, maybe even the British government, I don't know, about the concerns you have on behalf of the timber industry and the possible solutions that exist. What kind of hearing are you getting?
Well, the timber industry have been doing it themselves and very effectively, I think. Look, I think you've certainly seen a shift since the start of the year in terms of the Irish government's approach. You know, we saw in January the Taoiseach mobilising all government departments now to start preparing for a no-deal scenario. So that work is happening. We know it's happening with customs officials in Ireland who are now engaged with the EU authorities, but also with the British authorities. So the work is beginning to happen. And I suppose it's a question of nobody wants to have to sort of push the button. But you have to have the preparation done, and you have to have a clear understanding of how it's all going to work in the event that there isn't a deal, or that there's a deal which is, you know, not the optimal one that everybody wants, which is for the UK to stay in the customs union. So it's very tricky. But the key, I think, and the message has to be from all industry, really, the message has to be, you know, preparation is essential, and it needs to be happening now. And thankfully, that is happening in the last few months at government level.
John, how prepared is your company?
The preparation is being involved in forums like this, getting our message across to the political arena. We're looking at customs, how we're going to potentially deal with that. But, you know, at this moment in time, we don't have a clear line of sight of what's ahead of us. And that's a major problem. It's a major problem for you know, the certainty of investment in the future of the company.
Are you holding back on investment?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. If anything, we're doing the opposite.
Right. Fergal, how do you see this playing out?
For us as an industry, the UK will always be a crucially important market. What we need to ensure is that we prepare over the next 6 to 12 months and ensuring that we reduce that uncertainty as much as we can and influence policymakers as much as we can. I think I'm relatively new to this industry, and I think a lot of your listeners will be surprised at the sheer scale of the family businesses that are across the country that are, some of them, greater than 100 million of revenue and support a lot of jobs. The opportunity is to grow that industry quite significantly over the next number of years. That will happen. It's just we want to make sure it happens in a way that doesn't have casualties along the way.
Well, you're a state-owned company. I mean, you have the ear of government, presumably. So what are you telling them they should be doing?
Certainly, we're very clear in articulating our view in terms of what needs to happen. And to be fair, the Department of Agriculture have been very supportive in understanding that and to bringing that to fore. We're probably on the edge of pushy in trying to drive some of these solutions and what needs to get done. And that's because we don't have the luxury of waiting. We need to be pushing this on and we need to be getting ready now. John mentioned the investment that he's making in his company over the next while. And if you look across the industry, I would say there's been probably 30, 40 million investment in the last 12 months alone. That will not continue to the same pace unless we get certainty in this. And it's a great story. And it's a story that we talk about energizing the rural populations and energizing rural economies. This is a story that we should allow to do that. So therefore, we're leaning on that message with government that we've got a viable answer to a lot of those issues.
Should taxpayers be worried about their investment in Cuilge?
No. We have a broad-based business. This year, we're generating about 60, 70 million operating cash and I plan to get to about 100 million operating cash. The focus of this is not, in our perspective, a defensive piece. It's about protecting that growth.
Okay. All right. I wish you well with your deliberations as this unfolds. It's going to take some time. No doubt. John Murray, Fergal Leamy and Lucinda Creighton, thank you for joining us. Okay, that's it for this week from Inside Business. My thanks to Owen Burke Kennedy, Lucinda Creighton, Fergal Leamy and John Murray. Declan Conlon produced the show with JJ Vernon as sound engineer. Don't forget you can get the latest business news straight into your inbox by signing up to our Business Today email at irishtimes.com. And you can also follow the Irish Times business feed each day on Twitter and Facebook. I'm Ciarán Hancock. Until next time, take care.